This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will look back to the Nixon administration's efforts to end the war in Vietnam. The phrase that Richard Nixon used, his description of the goal, was peace with honor. And we'll be talking this morning with the author of a new book that suggests that, in fact, the administration came up short on both counts. Our guest is Larry Berman. He's professor and director of the University of California's Washington Center. He has written on Vietnam before. His new book, by the way, is titled No Peace, No Honor, Nixon, Kissinger, and Betrayal in Vietnam. It's published by the Free Press. His other books include Planning a Tragedy and Lyndon Johnson's War. He's also appeared in several major TV documentaries on the war and is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, your questions and comments for people who are listening are certainly welcome. All we ask is callers just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along, but anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. That means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Professor Berman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
Glad to be here.
We appreciate it. Researching for other scholars, researching this topic has been difficult in the past, largely because Nixon and Kissinger tried very hard to control primary source materials that one would have used to research just exactly how all this happened, the secret negotiations that Kissinger was involved in, and so on. And you've been able to, I think, take advantage of some material that others had not had. What sort of things have you had access to that others, journalists and historians and so forth, in the past could not have drawn on?
The first point, this is very important. I'm glad you've raised it right here at the outset, which is that Nixon and Kissinger have done everything possible to basically present to the American people their view of peace with honor in their memoirs. And they use classified materials in writing their respective memoirs, and then through deed of gift and other restrictions, lock them away in the National Archives or the Library of Congress so that no one could get to them. And the truth is, even today, there's probably about 85 to 90% of the material is still classified. Most of Kissinger's personal papers having to do with his role as National Security Advisor to the President, for example, we won't have access to until 5 years after his death. He did that through a deed of gift in the Library of Congress. I was able to utilize material because of a congressional inquiry into the POW, the status of POWs and MIAs, really MIAs, the Kerry Committee. That, through a congressional subpoena, actually led to a review of all of the Kissinger-Nixon papers and the negotiations with the Vietnamese. Any time the term political prisoners or the subject of political prisoners or POWs and political detainees was mentioned, that was declassified in a document. Now, what that meant was sometimes in a 30-page memorandum of a meeting between Kissinger and Lee Duc Tho, maybe two pages were declassified. That would mean nothing ordinarily, but what it did mean was I was able to compare those two pages with a complete account that the North Vietnamese have released of the meetings. And one of the things I immediately discovered was that the North Vietnamese translation of these meetings and their account of the meetings were very highly correlated, probably 95% with the U.S. account of those meetings. So I then knew that the Vietnamese account was fairly accurate. And the great irony here is that I was relying originally on a Vietnamese account of meetings between Kissinger and Tho, and all I had was two pages of a meeting with Kissinger from the United States version. And then slowly but surely, other material started coming out, Tony Lake's papers. He took notes of meetings and others. And I was able to reconstruct basically every single meeting that Kissinger and Tho had by probably combining and using six or seven sources. Having said that, I'll be the first to admit that I envy the next generation of historians and scholars who might have access to the complete record, because I still didn't have access to the complete record, and I did the best I could because of all of the obstructions that particularly Kissinger has erected for scholars to pursue the truth here.
Let's start here actually before the election or before Mr. Nixon takes office, because one of the things that you write about is goes back to 1968. At this point, we knew that that Lyndon Johnson would not run again, and that we were set up to have this this context between Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon. And your argument is that the Nixon campaign attempted to persuade the government of South Vietnam to be uncooperative in the efforts that the Johnson administration was making to try to get a settlement. And the idea is that Nixon was, his people were trying to persuade the South Vietnamese that they would ultimately get a better deal if Mr. Nixon was elected rather than Mr. Humphrey.
Absolutely. The South Vietnamese knew that if Humphrey were elected, that within 6 months a coalition government would exist in the South and the or in Vietnam in general, and that the United States would be out. They feared this terribly. Nixon, indeed, the evidence now is available that Nixon did, through Anna Chenault, promise President Tu that if he didn't go to Paris, he'd get a better deal. Then the intermediaries were used, the fact is that President Nixon owed his election in 1968 to President Tu. And that is really crucial to the story I'm trying to tell, because it is very fair to say, why didn't if the only obstacle to peace, as Kissinger and Nixon say in their memoirs, was that the United States refused ever to dump President Tu, that was the only obstacle between 69 and 73, that the United States, they say, refused to dump Tu or ask him to step aside, why would Nixon hold on to Tu so long? I mean, after all, this country has got a long history of getting rid of political leaders one way or another. They could have convinced Tu to step aside, but it's my firm belief that Nixon not only believed that Tu was the reason he became president, but even more important, and this is, I believe, something that we can discuss later about the Plumbers and Watergate and Daniel Ellsberg, which is that Nixon believed that President Tu had the evidence that could be revealed at any time of this extraordinary relationship between the Nixon camp and the government of South Vietnam. And Nixon was a candidate at this time, running against Hubert Humphrey for President of the United States, that if released would have been a political bombshell and damaged him tremendously. He feared that Tu would release the information of the contacts between Anna Chenault and Spiro Agnew. And if that happened, Nixon's political career would have been over well before the Watergate affair. Hmm.
So it's your belief that the apparent inability of the Democrats, Johnson and then also by implication Mr. Humphrey, that the fact that it looked like they didn't have what it took to settle the war weakened Humphrey enough so that that helped in the election of Richard Nixon.
Absolutely. Humphrey's Salt Lake City speech in September of 1968 or October of 1968, in which he said he would endorse a complete bombing halt, sent shivers down the South Vietnamese, particularly President Tu and Vice President Ky. And that's when these contacts between Chenault and also Bu Diem, the Vietnamese ambassador to the United States, really heated up. And very clear signals were sent to President Tu, don't go to Paris, don't begin the negotiations until after the election, and then after the election, we'll cut you a better deal. And they believed it. And it happened to be true, by the way, too. They were certainly, if you were in South Vietnam or you were South Vietnamese, you had to believe that you'd get a better deal under Nixon than you would under Humphrey.
Mm. Although, of course, the irony is that, as it turned out, that probably they, at least the result that they had feared, perhaps the reason that they would have thought they would be better off with Nixon president, in fact, it turned out to be exactly what they feared. The first talks, the secret talks between Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho took place in January of 1970, and we can talk about that, which you explore this in some detail. But it's, I guess, interesting to note that the precedent for having a two-track kind of proceeding, where there were public talks, which essentially were not the real talks, and then there were secret talks that they were the real talks, actually goes back and not very long after the Nixon administration set up, there was the first secret meeting between Henry Kissinger and a North Vietnamese, and I think that this also took place in Paris, that seemed to set this pattern for the public talks and the secret talks.
Absolutely. I mean, for the Nixon administration, secrecy was always the key. Now, clearly, some degree of secrecy in negotiations is essential. No one would deny that. The problem is that for Kissinger and his negotiations, the level of secrecy would include not only the public, but even members of their own administration. And the cost of it was that there was never an agreed-upon position that the United States could actually say, this is our negotiating position with the North Vietnamese. It was all being done in secret. And never once did Henry Kissinger or President Nixon sit down with the South Vietnamese leaders and say, okay, this is what our position is going to be as allies in negotiating against the communists in the North. And as a result, you know, the South was cut out entirely of what was going on in the secret negotiations. It wasn't until they became public and they realized the level of betrayal that Kissinger really had engaged in here, how much he had given away, literally guaranteeing the defeat of South Vietnam.
Let me just quickly introduce again our guest, if you might have tuned in the last few minutes. We're speaking with Larry Berman. He's director of University of California's Washington Center. Is the author of several books dealing with Vietnam. The most recent is titled No Peace, No Honor, Nixon, Kissinger, and Betrayal in Vietnam. It's published by the Free Press, and it looks at the particularly closely looks at the secret negotiations between the United States and in the person of and Henry Kissinger and the North Vietnamese that ended the Vietnam War. Questions welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Also in 1969, the Nixon administration was considering a very, very aggressive attack against North Vietnam. This was the thing that was called Operation Duck Hook. And he apparently decided not to. Why the decision to hit the North Vietnamese so hard and then, or the plan to do that and then the decision not to do it?
And, of course, then the regret that Nixon always had for not doing it, mm-hmm. which is also worth thinking about the implication of that. Duck Hook was the savage blow that Nixon had planned to deliver if Ho Chi Minh failed to show any interest in the original peace feelers and negotiating points that the United States had offered when Nixon first came into office. But of course, those peace feelers all left two in power, and not only that, but really were nothing more than just starting points for prolonged negotiations. And the North Vietnamese weren't ready to settle yet. They didn't have any troops in the South yet that could stay. They hadn't won the negotiating battle, so they really had no intention of negotiating seriously. So Nixon, in frustration, of course, turned to his military planners, and they came up with a very, very detailed plan, a script. The presidential speech that Nixon was going to deliver to the American public has just been declassified. I reprinted in my book where he talks about what would have amounted to destroying wholesale large amounts of the human population in North Vietnam, flooding, the bombing of dikes, flooding, leading to massive destruction, all intended to bring the enemy to their knees. The problem was with that when the Secretary of State, William Rogers, and the Secretary of Defense heard about this, they both objected strenuously because, first of all, they pointed out that Nixon had been elected, after all, on the platform of ending the war, but that he had a secret plan, and that the secret plan was to destroy North Vietnam. That wasn't the way to go about it. And secondly, the anti-war protests were just beginning to mobilize in Washington, D.C., and Nixon was convinced that perhaps this was not the best way to go, and he tabled that savage blow. Years later, Alexander Haig, Richard Nixon, and Henry Kissinger all regretted the decision not to have implement Operation Duck Hook and Savage Blow back in late 1969 because they believed the war would have ended. And I think they're incorrect in that. I think at that period, this is before the engagement with China, et cetera, it would have led to a much wider conflict. But they are correct. They could have at any time destroyed North Vietnam.
As I mentioned a little bit ago, the first meeting between Henry Kissinger and Lê Duc Tho took place in Paris in January 1970, and then they off and on would meet for a couple of years. before things finally got worked out. And you present in detail, in thorough detail, you know, what happened at these meetings. And as you said, you could, in fact, draw on some of the notes that Kissinger's aides had taken, but also the record that the North Vietnamese had about what took place, and that it was stuff that had not been previously available when you look at Mr. Kissinger's accounts of what happened. And as I say, it's explored in great detail in the book, but maybe the most straightforward way that we could talk about this would be maybe to talk about when the two sides sort of came to the table for the secret talks. What was it that each side wanted? Maybe start with the North Vietnamese. What was it that they wanted?
They wanted the aggressor, the United States, to remove all of its troops. That was their number one demand. The United States was always called the invading army, and the invading army had to remove its troops. Now, this is very important because the South Vietnamese believed that the only invading army in South Vietnam was the Northern troops. And, of course, the Northern troops were all allowed to remain in Vietnam and remain in place by 1972. We can come back to that later. But the North Vietnamese always insisted that the only invaders were the United States, and they had to leave. And, of course, we did leave. Second demand they made was that President Tu and what they called the Saigon administration, they never referred to it as a government. They didn't believe it was a government. They called it an administration, that be dumped, that they be replaced, and a coalition or some sort of government neutrality be put in its position. Those were their. And then third, that the United States dismantle all of its bases, all of its equipment, and leave Vietnam. Those were their major demands when the United States first sat down to negotiate in 1970 with them.
Okay.
And it's important to point out that the United States did disengage, obviously. But the North Vietnamese were permitted to keep their troops in South Vietnam.
That was seems to be one of the big puzzles here, because of course the North Vietnamese, they never actually admitted they had troops there,
right.
And their goal, because they still intended to, is what they wanted to do was to take the South, and it would certainly be facilitated if having troops on the ground. So the great puzzle seems to be that it seems that the United States gave the North Vietnamese everything they wanted, including that, which was certainly seemed to be an important would have been an important piece of the puzzle as far as the North Vietnamese are concerned, and sort of guaranteed that what we had been fighting for and about all those years to prevent would actually happen. So one wonders what Kissinger and what the U.S. government was thinking here.
Okay, well, this is why the secret plan that I try to unveil, that I do unveil in my book, but I want to talk about momentarily. But again, to put all the listeners on equal footing here, the United States in 1969, our position was mutual withdrawal. We would withdraw all of our troops from Vietnam, and the North would, from South Vietnam, and the North would withdraw all of their troops. That was the key negotiating point in 1969. And in 1973, what we ended up with was unilateral withdrawal. We withdrew all of our troops, and the North was permitted to keep all of their troops in the South. When the South Vietnamese learned about this, they realized that they had been betrayed, because to the North, the troops in the South were not foreign troops. They were not aggressive troops. They were Vietnamese on Vietnamese soil. And, of course, the North believed that all of Vietnam would be united once the United States left. And every time that Kissinger would raise this in a meeting, and you've read the book and you've seen the transcripts, Le Duc Tho would say only one thing. First of all, you know, these are not foreign troops. We do not acknowledge them as foreign troops. And if you persist in talking about them as foreign troops, meaning the North Vietnamese troops, then we have nothing to say to you. And Kissinger eventually gave in on that. He said, okay, fine, then they can stay. 150,000 troops can stay in the South. Nixon, many years later, acknowledged this was the biggest mistake that he had allowed Kissinger to make in the negotiation, to keep the troops there. But the South Vietnamese, you know, they were very wise. They understood the implication of this. And therefore, this led Kissinger and Nixon in 1972, because I think they understood what they had given away here. They made these secret promises to President Tu, which was, we understand that these troops are a threat to your viability. We couldn't get them out. And if they threaten you, we'll come back and we will bomb. But we can't bomb and we can't destroy the North until we have a signed agreement. So sign this accord, agree to the accord, because you won't be able to wave the treaty at the invading North Vietnamese. They only understand one thing and fear one thing, and that's the B-52s. So it's really the essential place where the negotiations fail, which is on the question of mutual withdrawal. And the implications of that to the entire negotiations.
Well, it seems to be a very central point here that you're making, that the Nixon administration didn't want to be seen as losing the war, and that, in fact, they understood that the North Vietnamese would do what they ultimately did, and that they knew that also under rather limited set of circumstances, probably would the Congress and the people of the United States approve continued military involvement of the United States there. So it seemed that they had this idea that here's an agreement they knew that would fail, and that then when it did fail, they would have justification to go to continue fighting. So that in fact, they really didn't see this as an end to the war at all.
I call it continuous war. I call this the second Gulf of Tonkin resolution in the book, which is the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, of course, got us into the war, and the Paris Peace Accords were intended to keep the America perpetually engaged in Vietnam indefinitely and certainly through the end of the Nixon administration. Because what everyone, again, has to remember is that in 1973, Watergate, no one knew what was going to happen to the Nixon administration yet. The Watergate Five hadn't pleaded guilty. Nothing really had happened. It was just a small investigation. Most people, everyone would have thought Nixon was going to complete a second term, and on the ledger, on the Nixon presidency, were going to be the great foreign policy successes of China, the Soviet Union, and a free Vietnam. Nixon was going to turn over the keys to the White House to the next president, and there was going to be a South Vietnam. And the only way he could guarantee that was to make a promise to President Tu that as soon as you sign, it's going to be just like Korea. And what he meant by that, as you know from reading the book, this is a very detailed discussion these guys had, which was that once an American president signs an agreement, the American people don't have any idea what's in it, but they think it's important if the American president signed it, and all we got to do is rally the American public, we'll rally the silent majority, we'll tell them that the commies have violated the treaty, and we're going to bomb them to smithereens if you sign the agreement. We can manipulate them. It was all about spin, and here the minutes are really quite detailed, because on both sides, the North Vietnamese side and the U.S. side, because the POWs were involved, and Nixon kept telling, and so therefore the documents were declassified, Nixon and Kissinger would tell Tu, the minute the last American POW is out, which is 60 days after the agreement was signed, we'll be back. And, of course, this is what led Admiral Zumwalt and others to say that two words could never describe the policy that Nixon and Kissinger had. One was peace and the other was honor, because the American public were never let in on the idea that we would be back within 60 days after the signed agreement. Hmm.
And it was afterwards, and presumably still, Nixon and Kissinger said, the reason things didn't work out the way they thought they would, they said, well, it was Watergate. It made it impossible for them to fulfill the plan the way that they thought that it was going to go.
Today, Kissinger would say that if it wasn't for Watergate, Nixon would have destroyed them. And, of course, this assumes that Nixon was prepared to have a constitutional battle with Congress over war powers. But Nixon was convinced, as is Kissinger remains convinced, that if not for Watergate, they could have convinced the silent majority and another segment of the American public that the communists had violated the treaty and we were going back. And, of course, all of this was their plan. And they are correct. Watergate did prevent them from doing that because Nixon had one constitutional crisis. He couldn't afford another. And all the promises to Tu went down the drain. And the country known as South Vietnam ceased to exist by 1975. And there's that one meeting that you probably recall reading about where Alexander Haig, who was, of course, Kissinger's assistant at the time, was meeting with President Tu. And President Tu said, Have you ever seen a peace accord in the history of the world in which the invading army was permitted to stay? And he told Haig, this would be the equivalent if Russia invaded the United States and afterwards the troops were allowed to stay in the United States and we were going to call it a peace. And and Haig said, don't worry, we'll be back. And this, to me, is one of the great deceptions and one of the important parts of my book, which has taken a long time for us to find. And no reviewer so far has questioned this thesis because we've got the goods, we've got the evidence on this. I don't think Kissinger can find a defensible position on this. Hmm.
Do you think that the South Vietnamese thought that the United States would be back, or that they thought essentially they had no choice, that the U.S. was going to do what it wanted to, and maybe they hoped that things would work out but feared that they wouldn't?
I think the South Vietnamese believed that Nixon would be president through 1976, and that they would have 3 years to prove to the administration they were going to get massive influx of equipment through the enhanced programs. They were going to get support, and they were prepared over a period of 3 years to defend their country. And by the way, the recently declassified documents from Hanoi's Politburo and also from the Soviet Union through the Cold War projects have shown that really Hanoi itself was prepared. They weren't thinking of conquest prior to 1976 either. This was going to be a period in which both sides were going to have an opportunity to dig in and defend themselves, etc. But then the weakening administration gave the North the opportunity to move in much quicker, and there was no equipment for the South to defend themselves. I believe if the South had been given the opportunity for those 3 years, that they would have been able to not only defend their country, but that it's very likely there'd be a South Vietnam today.
So you actually believe this idea that it was called Vietnamization of the conflict, this idea that the United States could pull out but then make sure that the South Vietnamese had the materiel and to continue to fight, that it's possible that actually would have worked.
I think it was the only chance of South Vietnam's survival. Whether or not it would have worked, I don't know. I would say the odds were certainly better than 50%.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here, and again, we're speaking with Larry Berman. He's professor and also director of the University of California, Washington Center, has written several books on Vietnam, including Planning a Tragedy and Lyndon Johnson's War. He has appeared in several major television documentaries about the war. His most recent book, the one that we're talking about here this morning, is titled No Peace, No Honor, Nixon, Kissinger, and Betrayal in Vietnam, published by the Free Press, that takes a close look at particularly at the secret negotiations between the United States and North Vietnam that ended up ending the war. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Having had the opportunity to look at transcripts, notes from the talks between Kissinger and Lê Đức Thọ that previously would not have been available. It was before we pretty much would have had Henry Kissinger's account of what happened. Now that you have a more full account of how these talks went, what does one, if one asks the question, what sort of negotiator, how skillful, how able is Henry Kissinger, what sort of impression does one come away with?
I think in these negotiations, it's really hard to believe how he won a Nobel Peace Prize. First of all, A, because of the result, but B, in the negotiations, he gave away just about everything important. As you know, again, from reading the book, and as any of your listeners can actually learn from just reading the Haldeman diaries or listening to Nixon tapes, Nixon, the Watergate tapes, Nixon himself had lost faith in Kissinger as a negotiator in 1972. And one of the remarkable things that occurs between October and December of 1972 is the ascendancy of Alexander Haig, and because Nixon wants Haig there, first of all, not really trusting of Kissinger, and secondly, recognizing slowly but surely how much had been given away at the negotiating table. Kissinger's skill has always been his personal diplomacy, his ability to, he and Lê Đức Thọ got along fairly well, they liked to joke together, etc. But the adherence to secrecy And this very close group of people he surrounded himself with, I think, does not bode well for his roles as a negotiator. And today, in retrospect, we now know, of course, that the Secretary of State, the State Department, Defense Department, the Joint Chiefs, all of them were kept out of the loop by our chief negotiator. And as a result, it was never an agreed-upon position, no negotiating point. And this is why no one was ever asked, well, how are we going to implement this? You know, Kissinger negotiated a treaty, yet no one ever gave any serious consideration on the United States side as to how are we going to make sure a ceasefire in place works, what are the procedures going to be. The only thing we cared about was getting our POWs back and getting an accounting for the MIAs, which was very important. But on everything else, there was a very casual, very superficial interest. And so the next question is, well, why? And my answer is, of course, because Kissinger fully expected this treaty to be violated and expected the only enforcement mechanism that would work would be the return of the B-52s. The treaty itself was never going to be an enforcement mechanism.
So from the beginning, the long-term plan was we need to establish an excuse to continue fighting.
Absolutely.
And after we wanted to get the prisoners of war out. That was extremely important.
Getting the POWs out, getting the MIAs as best we could account for, and letting the American people believe that we had disengaged to create the stage for an American reengagement is the story that I tell in this book. And, you know, over and over and over again, in these newly declassified documents that Kissinger does not use in his memoirs, and certainly Nixon does not in his, we see over and over again President Tu is being told that the Paris Accords link us legally to the long-term interests of South Vietnam. It gives us a basis to come back. We can rally the American people once it's violated. We expect it to be violated, and the minute we get our POWs back, we will be back. We won't have to haggle over proof. This is something that I hope, you know, Kissinger will be forced to address very shortly.
We have a couple of callers, and so we'll bring some listeners into the conversation. First is in Charleston, and it's line number 4. Hello?
Yes. I was just wondering, with all this secrecy from the American people at that time, how were they able to keep so much away? And we realize there has to be some secrecy, but that seems extreme. And I think that for us to know what it was might help us prevent that in the future. I'll hang up and listen to what your guest says.
Sure. I think that's an excellent question. How is it that the United States managed to keep the secret talks secret?
Well, they went to Kissinger went to elaborate lengths to get in and out of Paris. He would leave on a Friday night. He would travel under an assumed name on a private transport. He'd be picked up in the middle of the night. He would crouch down in a Citroën's. He would basically, and it was not until Nixon revealed the existence of the talks in 1972, January of 1972, that the American public knew that these private meetings, 12 in all, between Kissinger and Lee Duc Tho had occurred. And how he was able to do it was a concerted effort by the United States government, and particularly the President of the United States and Nixon, to basically have all this camouflage. Calls were diverted, airline itineraries were if we could secretly bomb Cambodia for over a year, we could certainly get Kissinger in and out of Paris for 12 meetings. I think it would be more difficult to do that today with the press, the role of the media in the press and surveillance, but back then. And it'll be very interesting, by the way, and again, in the next 5 or 10 years when the French intelligence declassifies or makes available their own records, because certainly the French knew that Kissinger was coming in or out. And, you know, he never had to go through a customs agent in one of these trips, which he always bragged about, because that was really quite an accomplishment. The other part of the secrecy question, of course, is that if the woman who just called were to go to Washington, D.C. today, where I'm living part of the time now, and go out to the National Archives and ask to see these records, here we are over 25 years later, and you would only be able to see just a very, very limited amount. So the government has been able to keep secret the record of these secret meetings for so long. And we still do not have a complete set of of documents to read. They still remain classified, and that is even more troubling to me, given the 25 years that have expired since the Paris Peace Accords.
Next caller is in Chicago, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. I wonder if you've given any thought to, and if you have, how you would characterize the legality of Nixon's behavior in all this in the beginning, in negotiating secretly, directly in opposition to his government during wartime. I consider that treason, basically.
So did Lyndon Johnson, and in the Johnson law, it's an excellent question, and one that I've been asked before, and I believe that it when the complete record is declassified or made available, which will still be another, it's still sealed, believe it or not, for another 40 years. That's how hot this file is, and the story behind that is in my book. It's a very interesting one. I can't tell it in the art. I can only give you a one-minute synopsis, which is that Lyndon Johnson, of course, was no novice to politics, so he had illegally wiretapped the Chenault and the Nixon headquarters. So he knew that, and he had secret surveillance on Nixon. So Johnson knew what Nixon was up to, and in the White House, he and Walt Rostow had these big, a series of very big meetings about whether or not they should reveal to the American public what Nixon was doing. And Johnson felt no, because if you revealed it, would destroy the very fabric of American society. I think it was a poor decision by Johnson, but he was really afraid of doing it. Those files have been locked away for originally 50 years, and then they've been relocked up again. It's a very, very hot file. But those of you who have read Stanley Cutler's book on the mix on the Watergate tapes can find a delightful conversation in there between Johnson and Nixon on this subject, because Johnson had the evidence. It definitely was treasonous, but until the if indeed the documents confirm that this kind of activity was engaged in, as I believe it was.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we'll go to line number two next. This is Champagne. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to clarify the issue of who invaded whom. I mean, when did North Vietnam send troops into South Vietnam?
When did they send them?
Yeah.
Well, they sent them in as early as 1954.
No, I mean, when, in terms of the 60s, I mean, I've been led to understand that North Vietnam, you know, reluctantly and relatively late, sent troops into South Vietnam, I think as late as late 64, early 65.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah.
So, I mean, we did invade South Vietnam, right? To fight a war against the people of South Vietnam.
It's a good question. Let me rephrase it by just asking or just making a statement, which would be that there was a country of South Vietnam, and there was an elected government of South Vietnam. And that government of South Vietnam had asked the United States to come and defend it against the North, which, of course, the North and South Vietnam were created by the 1954, you know, Geneva Accord. So I don't necessarily agree with your, at least the beginning of it, but that's the history that I see right there.
Well, I mean,
we were asked to come in.
Between 61 and 65, we were asked to come in basically to protect the government of South Vietnam against its own people, right?
Right. Well, yes, but we were also, I mean, to the United States, back then in 1961, and if we even take the 1950s, let's face it, South Vietnam was only important to the United States originally because of what its loss portended. That is, we feared the loss of South Vietnam to the communists and then the subsequent or the consequent dominoes falling, etc. I mean, this is back in the Cold War period. South Vietnam itself was never all that important to the original reasons that we went in. It was what its loss meant to first the Eisenhower and then the Kennedy and then certainly the Johnson administration.
Well, I mean, some of the histories that I've read show Marilyn Young and so forth.
Right, excellent book. Yeah,
is that Ho Chi Minh actually reined in the popular movement against Diem until the mid-60s, until when he could basically no longer, I mean, because of American involvement, he could basically no longer, you know, repress the calls for aid from the South. I mean,
that's one interpretation of the events in Maryland, I don't want to quarrel with that.
Yeah, I mean, I realize it's not the main point of what you're saying, but I mean, I think it's important to understand when the scene is set for these, you know, debates or, you know, negotiations about invading forces. I mean, I think that, you know, on the one hand, you know, North Vietnam could claim, I mean, even North Vietnamese troops could claim to be in their own country. But, you know, beyond that, they certainly responded to an invasion of South Vietnam against the people of South Vietnam by U.S. troops from 1961 to 1965.
Yeah, I understand that. And I guess to where I come down on this is when you go, when you talk to Vietnamese Americans today who fled the country in 1975, but who were Southerners and Northerners during this period, it would be very hard to convince them that these were not invading armies into the South. And they give you this best example, what happened in Vietnam after 1975. I mean, there was no unification. There was conquest. There was punishment. There was destruction. There was camps. There was, you know, this was not a national, quote, liberation movement of Vietnam. This was all about conquest. And in the end, those who lost were punished, relocated, and forced to either flee or die or went to re-education camps. So when all was said and done, I think when someone invaded, or these were invading troops into the South whenever we would. And of course, the North kept saying over and over again that was their point. We're not invading any country. This is our country. But in the end, in 1975, this was no glorious unification of North and South Vietnam. This was bloodshed.
Well, by 1975,
right.
They had been assaulted for 30 years.
Yeah, but the South, but the people who lived in the South were punished for their role in the war. There were many of them were relocated. They lost their livelihoods. They lost their homes, and so in the end, I mean, the question everyone has to face is: was it worth, you know, fighting for? You know, that is, you know, 48 million people went into some sort of slavery. That's how I end my book, and I end up talking about it. This is what's great about studying Vietnam and talking about it. We could go on for. For a long time talking about this interesting question.
Yeah. And I'm going to jump in here, and I hope the caller will forgive me, but I've got one more person I want to try to get in the time that remains, so we'll talk with them, and they're in Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hello. I have a question about Vietnamese history. I believe I have read that prior to the French conquest of Vietnam, the northern and southern kingdoms were only united about 50 or 60 years over the last 1,000 years. Is that true?
You know, I don't know the exact number, so I'll rely on your reading of history here.
But it's approximately true.
Yes.
So to say that the North was restoring one country is perhaps bending facts a bit. That their invasion of the South could be seen as an invasion, in other words.
That is how I've put it in my book, and one of the more interesting historical points here that you might be interested in would be that in 1954, when the Geneva Accords were signed, and of course, Vietnam was divided north and south. And by the way, Ho Chi Minh gave up a lot in 1954. They gave up territory under great pressure from the Soviet Union and from China, but they gave it up in return for the promise that free elections would be held within 2 years, which, of course, the United States ignored. But who was vice president in 1954? Richard Nixon. Who was president of the United States in 1973 when the Paris Accords? Richard Nixon. Who was the head of the communist delegation or the Hanoi delegation in 1954, Pham Van Dong, who was then the president of and the head of North Vietnam at the time in 1973, Pham Van Dong. What did they both take out of the 1954 accord and the lesson? For Nixon, that a piece of paper meant nothing and that the promise of elections could be ignored. Exactly what happened in 1973. And for Pham Van Dong, never again trust the Soviet Union, the Chinese, when it came to the interests of the Vietnamese. Negotiate your own position and don't be forced into any compromises. And that's exactly what they did in the negotiations between 1969 and 1973. And I find that to be one of the most interesting historical points that I was able to put together in the book as well. Both of these men never forgot what happened in 1954. They saw it through their own eyes, and by 1973, it was manifest.
Just to finish here, and we have about a minute or two, and unfortunately, we'll have to wrap up. And not to, I don't want to minimize the work that you've done with No Peace, No Honor. I'm just thinking about the fact that back at the time, I think that some of the people on the left, people who opposed the war, were saying some of these same things. And I wonder if now they might regard, and you might regard, what you've done here, taking advantage of a material that's now available, as something of a vindication of for the people that opposed American policy at the time.
Actually, what I'm finding in the reception of the book is that, and I was someone who opposed the war in 1965, 1966, and 1969. The point is that I'm finding that there are people on the left are finding vindication, and of all of the great ironies, people on the right are finding vindication for their position as well, because a lot of them read the book and they say, and certainly the reviews have said this, that this shows the level of communist treachery and duplicity in the negotiations. And of course, on the left, people draw just the opposite conclusion.
Well, I want to say thanks very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Our guest, Larry Berman. His book, again, if you'd like to read it, is titled No Peace, No Honor, Nixon, Kissinger, and Betrayal in Vietnam. It's published by the Free Press.